Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll talk to San Francisco Chronicle restaurant critic Mackenzie Chung Fagan to get the latest on the Bay Area restaurant scene, and we'll also want to hear what your favorite restaurants are. And we'll also be joined by Elizabeth Rosner, the author of Third Ear, Reflections on the Art and Science of Listening. But first, earlier this month, the new Daylighting to Save Lives bill came into effect. That law makes it illegal for drivers to park within 20 feet of a crosswalk. It's part of an effort by the state to address California's high pedestrian fatality rate, which is more than 25% above the national average. We're pleased to be joined by SFMTA head Jeff Tumlin to explain what this change means for San Francisco's drivers, its streets, and even its budget. Jeff Tumlin, welcome back to State of the Bay.
Grace, it's good to be here again.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about the title of this bill. It's called Daylighting to Save Lives. What does that mean exactly?
Well, in most of the rest of the world and in 40 other U.S. states, it's illegal to park right up against a crosswalk because if there's a parked car there and a child starts entering the crosswalk, the motorist and the child can't see each other until the child is in the traffic lane. So this simply requires that folks park about 20 feet away from the crosswalk so that pedestrians and motorists can see each other. It's one of the most cost-effective things we can do to advance pedestrian safety in California.
Well, as I understand it, the city is not getting any new funding to extend that red color on the curbs that will say, that will mean don't park here. So it's essentially up to drivers to know not to park within 20 feet of a crosswalk. Is that right?
That's right. And why we're trying to get the word out. We don't want to surprise anyone, and we're not going to be making any money off of these parking citations. What we really want to do is advance safety, not just here in San Francisco, but everywhere in the state.
So if you get fined for parking there, you won't have to pay the fine?
Oh, you have to pay the fine.
Oh,
but the
okay.
fine is just $40, which barely covers the time of the parking control officers and our administrative costs. Really about is safety.
And San Francisco has had a plan called Vision Zero. It started in 2014 to get to zero traffic deaths, but we've really not made that a reality. And in some cases, we've kind of failed to make the infrastructure improvements that we needed to. What has the city done so far, and what else can the city do to make our streets safer?
Well, we're investing in what we call our high injury network. That is the 16% of city streets that contribute about close to 80% of the severe injuries and fatalities. We've already daylit all of the intersections along the high injury network, as well as invested in signal improvements and traffic safety improvements and traffic calming throughout the network. And it's sort of damning ourselves with faint praise, but San Francisco has been able to keep its traffic fatalities flat, while in most cities in the United States, they have escalated significantly, largely due to speeding motor vehicles and an increase in aberrant motorist behavior.
Well, the new law, and I don't think we can say this enough, I mean, if you park 20 feet within a crosswalk, you will get a fine and also a citation, and it's a $40 fine. That's right?
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, and who decides the 20 feet? I mean, I can see this being a source of dispute for a lot of people. Is that one car length or two car lengths?
So that's exactly one typical car length. And the direction that we're giving to our parking control officers is, you can see a car length on the street. We know how long a parking space is. It's 20 feet. They're not going to be out there with tape measures. Just leave one car length between your car and the crosswalk.
And let's talk about other kinds of traffic that are on the street. Sometimes buses stop at crosswalks. Are they prohibited from stopping 20 feet within a crosswalk?
No, so this doesn't apply to anything other than parking. So we still have bus stops at our corners. We've got bike racks at the corners and fire hydrants and other things. This is really just about parking your car.
One complaint I hear often, not just in San Francisco, but any city, is the double parking that happens on the street. And now with these corners that are available, I can imagine, taxis, Ubers, Lyfts using that space to drop people off and kind of sitting there with a person in the car, not technically parked. Would that be worthy of a citation?
That is. So whether you're in the car or not, if you're stopped at the curb, it's still parking. So those folks can be cited.
And this means that I think the city would be losing about 5% of its parking spaces. What do you say to people who feel like, who say, you know, the city is so difficult to have a car in, this feels like an anti-car city?
Well, we know that cars are an important part of San Francisco's economy and for many of our residents. And we don't love getting rid of parking spaces, but we do need to prioritize safety when there's a trade-off in the street. And in a busy city like San Francisco, that's our challenge, is we always have to make these trade-offs between safety and parking convenience, or between one mode of transportation and another mode of transportation. In this case, we will be prioritizing safety and complying with the state requirements.
How are local businesses taking that? Are they feeling that this is a positive for them, or are they upset?
Well, for the most part, in our neighborhood commercial districts, we've already implemented the clear zones on the near side of every crosswalk. So there's not going to be a lot of change in our commercial districts. But for all merchants, they're going to be concerned about parking loss, not only for their customers, but also their employees. And so a residential block, a block away from our commercial districts, that's where a lot of service industry workers need to park, particularly late night workers. There's not a lot of transit options at 2 o'clock in the morning when people get off work.
And are you concerned about the lost revenue from parking meters?
Well, again, we've mostly adjusted the parking meters, so we're not expecting a significant revenue loss on the parking meter side. This is really about an issue around parking supply and parking convenience.
And remind us again, when does this law take effect?
Well, so the law was passed back in 2023. Right now, we're in the period where we're trying to get the word out, but citations don't happen until January 1st.
Good to know. Well, you know, this new state parking law is happening at a time when, Muni is facing a huge funding gap. And you recently announced that without additional funds, there will be a change in Muni service. You know, I wanted to ask you about that because I'm passionate about Muni. I love it. So tell us, like, what are the changes that Muni is facing because of this funding gap?
Well, so COVID impacted all of Muni's main sources of revenue, and that includes not just our transit fares, but our parking garages, our parking meters, and our commercial parking tax in the downtown. It's also affected the city's general fund, and so that's left us with a $300 million gap, and we've been managing thanks to state and federal relief. Those relief funds run out in 2026. So we're collaborating at the regional level for likely a ballot measure on the 26th ballot to save not just Muni, but BART, which is in an even worse situation than we are, as well as Caltrain and other operators. And we're also looking locally at what can San Francisco do to make the transportation system more efficient, to bring in new revenue and avoid catastrophic service cuts. That work will continue into January and February.
Well, one of the options that you laid out there is that Muni may have to suspend the cable car and historic streetcar service. I mean, that will save you $33 million. I mean, that just kind of hits at the heart of every San Franciscan.
Well, right. I mean, things like the cable car are sacred to us as an agency. This is the fate that we are working really hard to avoid. But we need to be honest with the public about what is at stake. $300 million seems a little abstract until we describe what it means in terms of eliminating.
Oh, I think we lost Jeff Tumlin, but he was talking about what would be eliminated in terms of if the Muni is not able to make its $300 million budget gap. And I could also add that Muni is proposing, this is not happening, but this may happen if it can't meet its budget gap, suspending service on lower utilized routes. That would eliminate 20 routes and serving about 50,000 riders. And that's a net savings of $63 million. I mean, reducing the service frequency as much as 50% of certain lines like the 14 and the 14R Mission or the 38 and the 38R Geary and all six Muni Metro lines. And that would save Muni $71 million. And then then even suspending regular bus and train service at 9 p.m. each night and replacing that with a less frequent OWL service. That's going to affect as many as 28 routes and, you know, result in a net savings of $14 million. But still not enough, perhaps, to solve the problems with Muni. And it looks like we have lost Jeff Tumlin. And so we're going to take a break and leave it there. We want to again thank SFMTA head Jeff Tumlin for joining us, and we appreciate his time. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to Chronicle restaurant critic Mackenzie Chung Fagan for an update on the best restaurants and best dishes around the Bay. That's right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. If you love food, if going out to dinner is something you live for, then our next guest might have your dream job. Mackenzie Chung Fagan is the Chronicle's food critic. She started in that role in January of this year, and Fagan knows the power of a good review. Her grandparents owned Henry's Hunan, which was catapulted into the national limelight with glowing reviews in the New York Times and Gourmet magazine. In fact, when I moved to San Francisco, it was the first restaurant I went to try. Mackenzie Chung Fagan, welcome to State of the Bay.
And thanks for having me. That's an amazing story.
Yeah, it was delicious.
Do you remember what you had?
Definitely something spicy. It was like, I mean, it might have been Szechuan chicken, which is not so like fancy, but I loved it.
We are known for spice.
Yes. We want you to be part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking with Mackenzie Chung Fagan for the next 40 minutes. What's a restaurant that she should review, and what's a hidden gem in your neighborhood? You can email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Send your questions, your comments, or fave places. So, Mackenzie, I must confess, when I think of a restaurant critic, I think of someone putting on a disguise, discreetly dining at the restaurant they're reviewing. And when you started at the job at the Chronicle, you said, I'm not using a disguise. It would be impossible to go under disguise in the world of social media. Tell us about how your first reviews went.
Yeah, I mean, it was a discussion that I was having with the Chronicle even before I was hired. You know, I said, if you're looking for somebody who is anonymous, it just might not be me. I'm a millennial. I've come of age in the era of social media. I've come of age in an era where freelancers are told, you know, you have to be your own brand. You have to build a brand. So I'm Googleable. You can see what I look like. And I also think that we are entering a new era where anonymity, it doesn't have as big a role to play in criticism, which is not to say that anonymity is not important and that there isn't a great value to being able to dine anonymously. But I think that there was a little bit of kabuki theater happening with a lot of longtime critics who had been in the same role, in the same market for decades. A little bit of, you know, I'm walking into a restaurant and I'm pretending that you don't know who I am, but obviously you do. And so at the upper echelon of restaurants, those with Michelin stars, those with a lot to lose, those who could afford to hire PR firms, all of those restaurants had access to photos of restaurant critics. And this is an open secret. We know it. You would go into the kitchen or service stations and there would be a photo of a critic. So I do think that there is a little bit of an equity component as well, where if some restaurants can afford to have a photo of a critic, why not have it be available to everyone?
Mm-hmm. But you do go not under your name, right? The reservations are made under a different name.
That's correct. Yeah, I don't want to give anyone a heads up that I'm coming in for dinner. So I do use aliases. I rotate them out. My goal is just to be anonymous or fly under the radar for as long as possible in a restaurant. And sometimes that means that I'm at the door and somebody recognizes me. Sometimes that means that I get to go the whole dinner without anyone knowing who I am. And a lot of times I don't know. Maybe I just am receiving excellent service as a member of the dining public, or maybe I've been recognized.
Do you go by yourself or do you go with other people?
I go with other people mainly for the purpose of trying as much of the menu as possible. If I'm scouting a place, it might be the only time that I'm dining there if I'm not reviewing. So I try to go with at least one other person.
And how often are you going out to dinner or for a meal in a given week?
Probably 6 days a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you maintain that? Do you ever get sick of it? Or I mean,
I miss cooking. I will say that I used to work at Bon Appetit, and You know, I'm an avid home cook. I just don't get to do much of it anymore. but, you know, dining out is still very much a pleasure. And I think if it stops being a pleasure, then that's probably an indication that it's time to move on. But for now, I still love it.
It seems like an amazing job 10 months in, or 11 months in.
It is.
So you got into writing about food sort of sideways. I mean, your family, you come from a restauranting family, but you were a documentary filmmaker before you became a food writer.
That's right. I kind of stumbled into food writing by accident. I was a documentary filmmaker. I was producing and directing mostly short form doc content for nonprofits and foundations. And I happened to be in Alaska for a summer producing a documentary film. And we were living on a boat without plumbing or electricity, which is a story in of itself.
Yeah.
But in order to get Wi-Fi, there were two spots in town that we could go to. And one was a coffee shop that had pretty bad coffee. And the other one was a distillery that made really good gin. Mm. And so I ended up spending a lot of time at the gin distillery because I had to. And
Of course, just for the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, exactly. For responsible working habits. And at the end of the summer, you know, I was friends with these people at this point, and I said, more people should know about what you do. I ended up writing an article. I got it placed, and then gradually the balance of what I was doing professionally shifted.
Yeah. There are so many, because you're a filmmaker, I'm very curious. There are so many shows about food. You know, I think of like the first documentary that I watched about food that I love was Jiro Loves Sushi. Just fetishized nigiri. As a filmmaker and a food writer, are there food documentaries or shows that you feel like, oh, that really did justice? The Netflix series on noodles and pizza, or The Bear, you know, is there something that you're like, oh, yeah, that really captures it?
I mean, I think Jiro Dreams of Sushi changed the form of what we think about as documentary filmmaking, because that filmmaker then went on to do Chef's Table as well. And it's interesting. I'm writing a piece right now about fine dining. And I think that we can start to see this trickle-down effect of programs like Chef's Table, but also of Top Chef, into the current generation of chefs in the kitchen. This sort of like fetishization of the chef as auteur that I think didn't exist before, certainly before Top Chef, you know, these competition shows that really elevated the art form on a national scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, I watch those competition shows and I think, what are they really showing in terms of those chefs showing? I mean, their ability to cook with random ingredients on a time frame, or that they really are good chefs? What do you think?
I mean, I think it's so hard in that format to convey deliciousness. Like, do you watch The Great British Bake Off?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, in these times, that's the only thing I like to watch.
That's right. It is our sustenance.
Yes.
It's hard to tell how good a baker is just by the feedback from two people, because, you know, you're not there, right? So you can, like, feast with your eyes and see who's very artistic. But you don't really, like, get a full sense of, you know, whose flavors are incredible or how, I don't know, the technique of someone. And so I do always find it to be such a challenging aspect of those shows, conveying the sensorial experience of tasting something. I don't know if there's anybody out there who works in food, TV, you know, call in and tell us how you do the edit.
Tell us how you do that. Well, you were talking about a palate and being able to taste something. And I wonder, as a food writer, is it essential to have a good palate? And what is a good palate?
I think it's incredibly subjective. And I do think that, I guess maybe objectively, some people are super tasters, whatever the scientific definition of that is. But, you know, it's something that I struggle with as a restaurant critic. I think I have a good palate, but I don't think it's my palate that qualifies me for this job, if that makes sense. You know, I guess you could, as part of an interview process, have 10 people blind taste a dish and, you know, who's the most accurate. But I don't necessarily think that that is what makes for a good critic. Maybe that's what makes for a good chef or a good blind taste tester. Is that a job?
I would take that.
But I think everybody's palate is different and is shaped by their own experiences, their own cultural heritage. And I think what makes you a good food writer is being able to translate what you are tasting into something that is more of a universal experience.
I think that's such a challenge. When I particularly think about this when I think about wine tasting. When somebody says, oh, that wine has notes of cherry or oak or whatever, and that doesn't necessarily mean anything to me. So I've read a lot of your writing in preparation for this, and I wonder, what do you think of when you want to try to convey the way something tasted? Is it how it made you feel or how it tasted to you?
I think it's more the former. I mean, of course, there are going to be some base flavor words, so you can give someone a sense of what they're in for. But I think a lot of eating for me is experiential and it's memory-based. What does it remind me of? Maybe it's not of a food at all. Maybe it's of something that I experience personally. But I think that, you know, there's a finite amount of words that we use to describe flavor. And how do you broaden that? How do you go beyond that to get a little more specific or at least interesting?
Mm-hmm. So what's your, like, Proustian Madeleine that you found so far that you've just said, oh, wow, that dish really took me to places?
Well, if you're referring to something that reminds me of, like, a very core childhood food, that childhood food would probably be Cheese Whiz. I ate so much Cheese Whiz as a child. And this goes out to all the fellow parents out there who have picky eaters. Mm. I was such a bad eater as a child.
Oh, you're giving parents a lot of hope here, Mackenzie.
I hope so. I want them to know that their picky child could be a restaurant critic in the future.
Well, so I guess the question is, was it Cheese Whiz on a cracker or just straight in your mouth?
Well, you know, my preferred vehicle would have been a soft pretzel.
Ooh.
Sophisticated,
I like that. I mean, actually, I don't know where you're getting your hands on a soft pretzel, but I'm impressed.
You know, those like in the freezer aisle, those super pretzels that came with the little salt packet.
Yes, exactly. So I would just probably eat the salt packet.
Yeah. And sometimes if I was feeling chefy, I would do a dash of Tapatio in the Cheese Whiz. DIY nacho cheese.
Nacho cheese.
Pretzels.
I mean, that is impressive. That is impressive. Well, this is, as listeners, this is the most delightful conversation you're going to hear tonight. And this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. And I'm Grace Wan. We're talking with Chronicle restaurant critic Mackenzie Chung Fagan. She's the person at the Chronicle who looks at the restaurants, who decides what to review. And we're curious, what's your favorite restaurant? What kind of restaurant do you think the Bay Area needs more of? Our phones are down tonight, but you can join the conversation by emailing us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. You can find us on Instagram and Threads at State of the Bay. So Rick in Citrus Heights writes, besides the yummy seafood and the yummy clam chowder soup, New England style, and the yummy Chinese food from Chinatown, and the yummy chocolate from Ghirardelli Square, the only other yummy thing I can think of is the San Francisco style of sourdough from Boudin Bakery and Cafes. I can't help but wonder if Ken Rosenthal, the founder of the St. Louis Bread Company, now known as Panera Bread, actually got their recipe to make San Francisco style sourdough from them. So a real fan of sourdough. What do you think? Is that a good bread?
I do. I also think that San Francisco, I was in New York for 20 years, but coming home to San Francisco, as a hobbyist sourdough maker, I rarely do it anymore. Not because I don't love it, but because there's so much good bread all around.
This is what I think too, Mackenzie. I mean, who's going to want to eat my very sad focaccia when I
would eat your sad focaccia.
I mean,
if
you
it's homemade, I'm still going to eat it, you know?
Well, you're kind and generous, coming from a restaurant critic. But I mean, if I could go to Semi Freddy's and get that herb slab, I'm doing that every day.
It really is an embarrassment of bread riches here. And I really think that bakers are experimenting in very cool ways too, like Rise Up Bakery.
We love Rise Up.
Rise Up Bakery.
They've been on the show, yes.
Yes, terrific flavors, things that I'm not going to attempt at home. I make one type of sourdough bread and it's the same loaf every time. And it's fine. It's fine. But like, I'm not going to experiment with all of the flavors that they do.
You're not going to put ube in your sourdough.
Because it's going to go wrong and then I'm going to have wasted a batch of ube.
Yes, exactly. Well, what do you think is distinctive about the Bay Area restaurant scene?
We eat really early here. This is one of my earliest reviews was about my utter shock at how early Bay Areans dine, and that I routinely shut restaurants down with an 8 o'clock reservation.
Yeah, no, that is a very true thing, especially from being in New York for 20 years. Yeah. You have forgotten.
Right. But that's the pessimistic take, I would say. Other than that, I mean, it is so wonderful to be back in San Francisco. I think the restaurant scene here is unparalleled. We've been such a pioneer for decades and decades. And I think that there's, you know, plenty of negativity and plenty of, like, you know, national haters about the state of the city. And I am so optimistic, not only about the Bay Area, but about the Bay Area restaurant scene. I think we have so much talent here. We've got incredible produce here. We have diners who care a lot, and just the diversity of cuisines that are represented all around the Bay as well. It's such an exciting time to be here.
How do you figure out where to go?
Well, I am part of an 8-member food and wine team at The Chronicle. And, you know, we're always looking everywhere. You know, we're reading Reddit. We're on social media. We're reading our competitors. Word of mouth, you know, where are people talking about? Where is an old spot maybe that we haven't visited in a while that suddenly is really good? So, you know, we will take any and all recommendations. And you can email me, mackenziechung.vegan@sfchronicle.com.
I mean, people, take that up. Mackenzie seems like somebody who will go anywhere.
That's true.
For a good meal. I mean, you've called the Bay Area the fine dining capital of the world. And when you think of places like New York, London, and Paris, that's saying a lot.
It is saying a lot, but I stand by it. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a very high number of fine dining restaurants per capita in the Bay Area. And, you know, when Michelin came to the U.S., they came to the Bay Area first. And I think it's for good reason. You know, and some of that is, you know, the bounty of the region. Some of that is the proximity to wine country. Some of it is money. You know, it's a very affluent region, and there's a lot of people who care about food and are willing to spend a lot of money on a meal.
You know, one thing I think we might take for granted here, especially if you haven't traveled outside of the state in a while. I was on the East Coast recently, and the produce is good, but, I mean, you can't get a great avocado in New Jersey, I've decided. I mean, they're fine, but they're just... Like, I walk into the local Safeway, I'm like, there's an avocado, Whole Foods or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, the proximity to produce matters.
We're spoiled babies. And, you know, you can get delicious, beautiful tomatoes in New Jersey
for
1 month out of the year.
Exactly.
And, you know, I have talked to chefs here who are not from the Bay Area, and just their shock and awe at going to the farmer's market and seeing... you know, strawberries next to autumn squashes.
Yes.
And they're both really good.
Yeah. I mean, we're growing tomatoes in our garden. I cannot believe it's November.
What
are seasons? I have sun golds out my ears, and they're delicious.
Put those on your focaccia.
That's an idea. I'm bringing it straight to the Chronicle. So you have a list, 25 restaurants to try now, that it's been compiled. And just there's some really great restaurants on that list and some hideaway places. Why don't you give us one or two that you might want to highlight for our listeners?
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is a list that my colleague Cesar Hernandez and I compile quarterly. So, you know, it began as the 25 top restaurants in the Bay Area, which is an impossible task.
Like,
you could name 25 of your favorite restaurants right now if I pressed you.
Yes.
So the way that we think about it a little bit is like... Where do we think that you should be going right now? Mm-hmm. What is compelling about a restaurant to visit right now? And we often get lots of reader comments that are like, how can you leave off, you know, this restaurant on the 25 best restaurants? And like, it's a little bit of a misnomer. It's a little bit like where we think that you should dine right now.
Yes.
Well, I'll ask you for this update, if you have it in front of you, is Four Kings on the list?
You know, I don't have it in front of me, but yes.
I'm pretty sure that Four Kings is still on the list.
Yeah, it should be.
It absolutely. So Four Kings opened earlier this year in the spring. If you haven't been, it is a restaurant in Chinatown, opened up by two alums of Mr. Jew's, one of those fine dining restaurants that I mentioned.
Yeah.
But this is not a fine dining restaurant. This is a very fun, casual, Cantonese-inspired spot to eat delicious food while you're drinking is how I would describe it. And the food is so flavorful. It's a beautiful interior space, kind of modeled on a Japanese izakaya.
Ooh, fun.
You know, you can see into the kitchen. The chefs are passing you plates as you're sitting at the counter. And it's just such a good time. And the food is so, so good.
Well, I noticed I pulled three off of that list that I've been to. Okay, Zuni, of course, everybody loves Zuni.
Yes.
Who doesn't want like a haystack of fries?
Correct.
And then Aziza, which I just was at over the weekend, and that's a kind of Moroccan-inflected restaurant. And I had the chicken bastilla there, which was a delight.
A classic, yes.
A classic. But there's one in Sonoma that I really think that listeners should make a trek for, and that's Valley Bar and Bottle.
Have you been?
I have been.
What do you think about it?
Well, I'm not a restaurant critic, but those soupy, brothy beans, I'll go every time for them.
I have a theory that if a restaurant has beans on the menu, they're going to be good.
Yeah,
you know, because beans are sort of the unsung hero of so many cultures, right? And it takes chutzpah to put beans on a menu to say, like, you should pay $17 for these beans.
Yes.
And I don't think I ordered the beans at Valley, but I have no doubt that the beans are good.
Delicious.
I loved my meal at Valley. It is absolutely the way that I want to eat. They really have my number. Like, there was just a course that was a wonderful wedge of cheese, and then it was roasted fruit in olive oil. I think it was plums, just roasted in olive oil, and that's it. That was the dish with really good bread, and I want to eat that all day.
Yeah, and they have a beautiful backyard patio. Listen, Evan writes, I feel like every type of cuisine has a version of the fried chicken sandwich lately. What do you think about the proliferation of fried chicken sandwiches?
I think it's a crowd pleaser. You know, I think that perhaps the fried chicken sandwich has surpassed, I'm not going to say surpassed the burger, but in terms of kind of like a current pop cultural hotness, you know, there was like the Popeyes hot chicken sandwich that was kind of a national phenomenon. I buy Evan's theory. I'm not mad at it.
I mean, I'm Korean, so Korean fried chicken and Korean hot chicken is obviously a thing. And there's nothing better than a soft roll and a crunchy piece of chicken. That, you know, who could say no to that?
Maybe some pickles, maybe some mayo.
That sounds pretty good, too. Well, you're listening to This State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan, and I have the absolute pleasure of talking with Chronicle restaurant critic Mackenzie Chung Fagan. We're talking about the Bay Area restaurant scene, what she feels about fried chicken sandwiches, which is positive. And we're hearing about what your favorite restaurants, what kind of restaurants you think the Bay Area needs more of. Our phones are down tonight, unfortunately, but you can join the conversation by emailing us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on Instagram and Threads at State of the Bay. Alice writes, I have a friend visiting San Francisco for the first time. Where should I take her?
Well, you did just mention Zuni.
Yes.
And I think that Zuni is a quintessentially classic San Francisco restaurant and is really great to bring someone from out of town. I would say go Friday lunch.
Ooh.
That's my recommendation.
And what do you get when you're there?
Friday lunch, you can get a burger, which is not always on the menu. But, you know, whatever is seasonal. Zuni is, you know, one of the classic sort of like local seasonal inspired California restaurants. And anything is going to be good that is featuring local seasonal produce. And I like going for lunch because it's just such a beautiful space. There's this long copper bar. There's all of these windows. And, you know, if it's sunny out, you can like catch some of the light through the windows. If it's raining out, you still feel cozy inside because there's a wood fire. But that would be my recommendation.
You know, that other nice thing about Zuni is the people who work there are just such professionals. You know, they've been doing it for a really long time. Not just the back chicken, the kitchen staff. I'm obsessed with chicken now. They have a really good chicken there. But it's just the fact that when you have your server staff, they really know what they're talking about. And there's such a level of pride and satisfaction that they kind of display about their restaurant. Every last one of them. So, and I think that's kind of unusual.
Yeah, I mean, excuse me, there was also a little bit of controversy with Zuni. I don't know if you followed this, about their tipping structure. Mm-hmm. So when they reopened after the pandemic, they said, we're going to change the way that tips are distributed so that we can pay back-of-house staff, more fairly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of their long-time servers actually left because they said, that's cool, but yeah, I can make more money elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there was a little bit of maybe growing pains, getting new people into the house. But it's such a quintessential San Francisco restaurant and so beautiful, mm-hmm, that I think that anyone who works there obviously must take great pride, yeah, in being at the iconic Zuni.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a little bit about fine dining or sit-down dining. But there's a piece that you recently wrote about probably one of the best Pakistani restaurants in the city is in the basement food court at the old Westfield Mall.
That's right.
So tell us about that, because I've never been, but it sounds amazing.
Get to the mall. It's called Mashallah Halal Pakistani Food Restaurant. Mm-hmm. And you descend the escalator. You go past the Wetzel's Pretzels and the Jamba Juice. You'll hit the Shake Shack, keep on going, and you will see a corner kiosk stall that looks very different from all of the other chain restaurants in the food court. And that is Mashallah Halal. It's run by a delightful couple, Muhammad and Rabia Wakar. And they're just making really great food. And they are making absolutely not mall food. Like, they're cooking lamb shanks, lamb chops in a tandoor that are incredible. And, the first time I went, I heard Muhammad say to another customer, how do you want your lamb chops cooked? Which is not something I have ever heard in a mall before.
You don't hear that at Hot Dog on a Stick.
You don't. I would be concerned, frankly. And then when I started talking to them, because I interviewed them for this piece, what I did not expect was that this review ended up also being a little bit of a love story, because their marriage sounds incredible. I was talking to Muhammad first, and really he just wanted to keep on talking about his wife Rabia and about how all credit he gives to her, his love, his companion, about how he wouldn't be where he is without her. And then I asked him to put her on the phone, and she loves him as well. And they just have an incredible romance and love story. And it makes you really happy to support them, mm-hmm, in addition to the fact that their lamb is really good.
I mean, it's like you described the chai that they're making, the chana masala. I mean, it all sounds delicious. It was one of those pieces I read, and I'm like, gosh, Mackenzie, I can actually smell the food. Mm. That just kind of came through to me, which was really fun. Let's get to some more comments. Rob writes, what are the best reasonably priced barbecue restaurants around here? And again, who makes the best fried chicken?
I will shout out one that I actually, mea culpa, have not been to yet, because my colleague Caesar reviewed them.
Okay.
And so as we sort of divide up, restaurants to review, often if he's reviewed something, maybe I don't make it out there, mm-hmm, immediately. But it's called Fix Q.
Okay.
It's in Alameda, and I believe it is Indonesian barbecue mashup, and it's supposed to be incredible.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And anything for best fried chicken?
Best fried chicken. Oh, man. I'm going to say Mini Bell's.
Okay.
Mini Bell had a kiosk in Emeryville, mm-hmm, but recently opened up a brick and mortar on Fillmore. She has an incredible story. She grew up in the Fillmore and always wanted to bring her soul food restaurant back home. And this past summer she did it. And the chicken's amazing. The collard greens are so good. Mm. Everything is great. Really recommend you go check it out.
Yeah, I know where I'm stopping tonight. Okay, after the show, one more comment I want to ask. Adam writes, I'm curious if the guest is only reviewing the food or the entire experience. I went to a restaurant on Treasure Island, and the whole experience was so fun. I think it made the food taste especially good. Are you looking at the whole ambiance as well as the food when you offer a review?
Absolutely. I think that's part of the experience. Otherwise, order delivery and sit at home on your couch, right? I think that we go to restaurants to be delighted, to be social, to see the vision that the restaurateur wants us to experience, and that includes the service, that includes the decor. It's the whole experience of dining out.
Yeah, it's one of the last things we like to do live. You know, it's like...
that and radio.
You know, I mean, radio, but also it's like everybody's sitting at home and watching everything on a screen, but you still go out to dinner with your friends.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, last question, Mackenzie. You say you don't have time to cook very much, but is there a dish that you've tried that has inspired you to try to make that at home?
Ooh, good question. Honestly, nothing comes... This is how infrequently I cook. I do still try to keep my freezer stocked with cookies.
Oh, good.
Because I think that's a nice thing to be able to just, like, bake off
one
or two at a time.
Yeah.
And we have a very strong chocolate chip cookie culture
mm-hmm.
in San Francisco. And the Chronicle, before my time, did a taste test.
Oh.
But I had a great chocolate chip cookie at Sandy's recently.
Okay. And where is that?
That is in the Hate.
Okay.
And that is a New Orleans sandwich shop. I don't know what is very New Orleans about a chocolate chip cookie, but it did inspire me to go home and make a batch.
Oh, I love it. Sandy's chocolate chip cookies and the Hate. Go look for that. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Mackenzie. It's been really fun talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
That was Mackenzie Chung Fagan. She's the restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Coming up next, we'll hear guest host Ann Harper interview local author Elizabeth Rosner about her recent book, Third Ear, Reflections on the Art and Science of Listening.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. Could better listening help heal our fractured world? Elizabeth Rosner thinks it can. In her new book, Third Ear, Reflections on the Art and Science of Listening, she uses personal stories and scholarly inquiry to examine how listening can build interpersonal empathy and social transformation. I'm so pleased Elizabeth Rosner is able to join us tonight. Welcome to State of the Bay, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're so happy to have you here with us to talk about this really interesting and thought-provoking book. I wanted to start by asking you about the title. I've heard a lot about Third Eye, but this is the first time I'd heard about Third Ear. Can you explain what that is and why you chose it as the title for your book?
Yeah, it's a great place to start because I, too, felt like Third Eye was something familiar to me. But when I came across a book by Theodor Reich, who was one of Freud's proteges, called Listening with the Third Ear, about psychotherapy and the way that the therapist and the patient would be interacting below the surface of what was being said and tuning in to the silences and the hidden parts of that conversation, both internally and externally. And I just became very fascinated by how that might relate to my own experience, both in my childhood and also in my connections with the natural world. So I started exploring both memories of what it had been like growing up in my family, where there was a lot of loud conversation in a multitude of languages, and also my feeling of consolation within the natural world, where I was also listening for, let's say, languages I couldn't necessarily speak or understand, but wanted to feel in my entire body.
Yes. My next question was about how you grew up in this multilingual household. Tell us a little bit about that and how you think that impacted your experience of listening.
My parents were both immigrants from Europe. They were both Holocaust survivors. My father was German. My mother was born in Poland. After the war ended, they met in Sweden as refugees. Swedish was their language of love. It was their language of exile and sanctuary. Eventually, they came to the United States and raised their children in English. But meanwhile, my mother retained her Polish, her Russian. My parents kept Swedish as their private language. German retreated into the background. Even though it was my father's native tongue, he chose not to speak it with us. And he, in fact, even forbade us from learning it because for both my parents, German was fraught with trauma and really painful associations. And so what I was learning, listening to all of this, was what was being whispered about, what was being withheld from me, what might I feel even more curious about because I wasn't supposed to know it. I was a very inquisitive child. I think I was also a lonely child, even though I had siblings and a lot of friends. There was something about my family configuration, my parents being Holocaust survivors, that I grew up feeling different from the other kids around me.
You mentioned in one scene that your friend was over and she said, your parents talk funny, they have accents, and it seemed as though you hadn't really realized that before. What was that like?
Yeah, until a certain point in my childhood, that was just the sound of my parents. And then it took someone else's listening to reflect back to me, oh, they don't sound the same to her as they do to me. And it really was one of those pivotal moments in my life that I tried in some ways to shape the book around those moments that I could remember when the sound of something or a listening experience shifted my whole worldview. And that was one of those moments where I thought, does she mean we're not like Americans? Does she mean she doesn't recognize me as being like her? Does it mean that we're the same but not the same? And that she was all getting that from how she heard something. Right. And it was the voices of what to me were just my parents. And so it just raised all these questions for me about what is normal and also how does listening affect who we are, how we identify ourselves in the world? How does it create connection and how does it sometimes separate us?
That's exactly what I was going to suggest, was that it goes to your broader themes in the book that talk about how listening can bring us together or separate us. You know, you've written in many other genres, including fiction and poetry and memoir. What made you want to write this book right now?
I really appreciate that question, because when you write a book, it's not just for yourself. Hopefully, it's a book that serves a bigger purpose for those who pick it up. I'm really interested in how my own experience opens the world up for me and hopefully for other people. So even if readers aren't sharing my experience, they might become curious about their own listening history or their own listening practices. And I also really wanted to keep drawing links and connections to the more than human world. How do we listen in the forest? How do we listen to the wind moving through the trees? How do we listen to birdsong? Even if we can't identify who those birds are, what species, what might we experience if we just let that wash over us or let that enter into our nervous systems? How might that bring a greater sense of well-being and also a sense of being connected to everything around us?
I was really moved to read that other animals talk to their children in baby talk. I thought that was amazing. And you have a beautiful passage in the book where you heard whale song. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that experience was like?
I love you referencing that bit about baby talk among many other species. I think that's one of those delightful aha moments that I had researching the book and that I hope readers share as well. So the part about whale song, in addition to writing about Roger and Katie Payne and their recordings of whale song in the 1970s that really transformed the planetary consciousness about whales and created a lot of bans on whaling and in a sense launched the Save the Whales movement, my own personal experience was hearing whale song underwater while I was snorkeling off the coast of Maui. And again, it was one of those moments in my life where I thought, I'm not really the same person anymore now that I've heard this sound, now that I've really been eavesdropping on this communication between these mammals that were miles away from me, sending these signals back and forth across the ocean in a way that I could feel in my body, I could take in through my ears. But that third ear listening practice is that it's more than just what we take in through our ears. It's what we allow to really touch us in our hearts or change our consciousness and change our sense of unity and holistic connection with the world.
You did so much research for this book and spoke to so many people, from scientists to podcasters to spiritual leaders. One statistic that really jumped out at me was that the average attention span of an American adult is 22 seconds.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, to be honest, I hope that was a reliable source, and I really can't pinpoint when that was measured. And there are plenty of us around, I hope, who can sustain for a full 10 minutes like we're doing right now. But we're just so distracted. We're being bombarded with stimuli all day long, even in our sleep. Our hearing never turns off. We're wired for danger. And so all those little pings and bells and signals to us that we need to look over there. Our animal nature is to be pulled away from what we're trying to focus on to make sure that nobody's trying to eat us. And so we need to keep practicing a recalming of our nervous systems. And a lot of what I write about in the book is not just how bad we are at listening or how anxious we might be and distracted we might be, but what are some of the places I have learned to go to for my own more relaxed, present state of mind? And to inquire for yourself, where do you find you're able to listen more fully, more deeply? What does it take? Does it take turning off all your devices while you sit and stay present with your loved ones? Does it mean going out into the woods and not listening to a podcast while you're walking? A lot of us are multitasking, and we're doing that a little too much, and we're sacrificing a lot of connection as a result.
Mm-hmm. Another statistic that jumped out at me was that people tend to listen to podcasts sped up.
It's part of thinking, I'm going to be more productive, I'm going to be more efficient with my time, and not really thinking about what gets lost and what you're giving up. So I think we forget that, what might happen if I slow down, just as an experiment? What would it be like to actually allow a lot more spaciousness into my listening practice? Maybe I'm going to listen better instead of faster.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great note to leave it on. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Elizabeth Rosner is the author of the book Third Ear, Reflections on the Art and Science of Listening. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much, Anne. You're a great listener.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We'll be off for Thanksgiving next Monday, but please join us on December 2nd at 6 o'clock when we'll hear about what this year's UN Climate Change Conference will mean for the Bay Area and also how the Bay Area will respond to the policies of the incoming Trump administration. And remember, subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen, and you'll never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have a question or comment about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at any time. We're here, stateofthebay@kalw.org. And also, if you have a story idea, throw that in as well. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Chris Nooney. It was engineered by David Kwan. Eric Jansen and Tariq Ansari were our board operators. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.